Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, March 7th, 2025, and our friends, Ambassador Chas Freeman and Colonel Wilkerson, are back with us. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Good to be with you.
Let's get started, Ambassador, with what Donald Trump said in his address to the Congress considering Ukraine. Here is what he said.
It has sent hundreds of billions of dollars to support Ukraine's defense, with no security, with no anything. Do you want to keep it going for another 5 years? Yeah, you would say Pocahontas says yes.
Yeah, this was the only time. Yeah. How did you find it, Ambassador, the whole thing, that the way that he was describing, he was addressing the Congress?
Well, it was an amazing hodgepodge of false facts, lies, insinuations, insults. You just heard the insult to Senator Warren of Massachusetts. Statements about amounts of money that had been spent on various things. Confusion between transgene and transgender mice, really a dreadful, dreadful experience. I watched the whole thing with horror.
Larry, go ahead.
Ditto, except for one thing. I have not watched a president address our Congress for some time. Actually, it started with my own president, George W. Bush, where I was actually there one time. And I said to myself, and I said to Colin Powell afterwards, this is the greatest farce ever conceived on the face of the earth. And we are responsible for it. And he didn't want to talk about it, of course. Later, we did talk about it rather seriously. And he more or less admitted that I was right.
It's a pageantry, sound and fury signifying nothing.
Yes. Couldn't have said it better myself than Shakespeare.
Here is the point that, Ambassador, that the point that he's talking about in terms of Europeans and the way that they have spent more in buying Russian gas than they have help Ukraine. Here is what he said.
Europe has sadly spent more money buying Russian oil and gas than they have spent on defending Ukraine, by far. Think of that. They've spent more buying Russian oil and gas than they have defending. And we've spent perhaps $350 billion, like taking candy from a baby. That's what happened. And they've spent $100 billion. What a difference that is. And we have an ocean separating us, and they don't. But we're getting along very well with them, and lots of good things are happening. Biden has authorized more money in this fight than Europe has spent by billions and billions of dollars. It's hard to believe that they wouldn't have stopped it and said, at some point, come on, let's equalize. You got to be equal to us. But that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Well, I think, first of all, we didn't spend $350 billion. It was more like $125 or $130 billion. And the Europeans spent more than we did, about $145 billion. So the figures are the product of what is known as the graduate of MSU, makes stuff up, totally wrong. And oddly enough, we have an inversion now. We are, as President Trump said, rather remote from Ukraine. The direct implications of events in Ukraine for us are not anywhere near as great as they are for those of its neighbors in Europe. And yet it's the neighbors in Europe now who are more belligerent than we. We have the Europeans meeting continuously, or intermittently, I guess, more accurately, to discuss how to do various military things they don't have the capability to do. They don't have the troops to deploy to Ukraine, even if the Russians would accept that, which they won't. This war began because Russia did not want to have a hostile military presence on its borders, and they're not going to accept a new hostile force, even if it is the rather small one that the Europeans could muster. It's a good thing that the Europeans are taking charge of their own destiny or attempting to do it. It's high time, 80 years after the end of World War II, and they have been content to sit back and allow the United States to maintain the order on their continent that they should be responsible for. So that is a fact. But it doesn't help to be snide and insulting and contemptuous of allies. That is not a good way in which to promote a more responsible European approach, in my view.
Larry, there is an article in the Financial Times. It says that France, England, and Germany had announced that they will make any agreement reached between Trump and Putin inoperative. How they're going to do that? Is that possible? Is that beneficial for them in the long run?
Well, anything's possible, I guess, especially given the situation that we have today. The part of this that troubles me the most is that Trump was embarked on and apparently was intent on, even though his intentions are sometimes very difficult to determine minute to minute, stopping this war. And that was favorable in my view. That's something that should happen. We've had far too many casualties, the bulk of them on the Ukrainian side, and we're looking at a country with, oh, give or take a few, 150 million people against a country that was somewhere around 40 million, that's probably down to about 22 million now. And a lot of that is people leaving, of course, but it's also dead people. I'm hearing from very reliable sources that it's probably close to a million on Ukraine's part and maybe 300 to 350,000 on Russia's part. This is preposterous that we're having this happen, and it's even more preposterous that people like Macron and Starmer and others are, because they really are operating on their prestige factor, is what I call it. They just don't like being beaten while they're in office. And they have been beaten, and they've been roundly beaten. And so now they're pushing things that are to reverse that loss, apparently, which aren't going to do a thing except deepen the loss. And I can't believe the French people are behind Macron, not just because they're not behind him. He's a dead man walking. If the French system were any better, he wouldn't be the leader anymore. And I can't believe they're behind Starmer either in Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland now. Maybe England, because I think of late England has gone batshit crazy, pardon my French. But this is really ridiculous. The man, no matter what you might think of him, posited a way, a process to get this ended. Let's do it. Let's get it ended. I don't care if he gets maximum credit for it, but let's end it.
Couldn't agree more. How you end it makes a huge difference, however.
Yes.
And that is really going to determine both the future of Europe and a good deal of what happens in the world order. And I think the focus does seem to be on a ceasefire, but that is not a fruitful approach. To me, this situation resembles that in Korea in the early 1950s. Where the fighting continued while the talks went on. And I don't believe the Russians are going to accept a demilitarized zone or any other sort of truce in Ukraine. They want a peace in Europe. They're confronted with people, I think epitomized by an American who lives in Poland and Applebaum, a writer and historian. And she is quoted as saying that victory is more important than peace, which I find really strange and utterly unpersuasive.
Yeah.
Actually, I find Anne to be completely out of touch with reality. And unfortunately, I find much of Europe to be out of touch with reality right now. As you and I have talked about, Nima, the world is changing. it's changing rapidly, far more rapidly than it did when power built up in the East and then shifted to the West, with America being the apogee of that power. Now the power is going back, and the power is going back to that magnet named China. It's going all the way through East Asia or Central Asia, and it's leaving us. We're saying it's a multipolar world. Well, okay, that's a fine way to say it. We're saying it's the death of liberal internationalism. Okay, scholars will call it that. We need a reality-based internationalism. We don't need the messianic Victoria Nulands building democracy from one end of the world to the other. What we need is an accommodation of this power shift, multipolar world, and getting busy with the most dangerous thing confronting us right now, which is a treaty-less world in terms of nuclear weapons, and a new arms race going bangers right now, so much so that it's got China wanting to build out to complete its arsenal to match ours and Moscow's, and the climate crisis. We cannot do this with Ann Applebaum's.
Agreed. And I think in the case of the Chinese nuclear build-out, the way to look at that is that the Chinese up to now had been content to have a sort of minimalist force de frappe, using the French term, take a bite out of a sufficient bite out of an adversary who attacks you with nuclear weapons to deter them. But they have now embraced our theory of mutual assured destruction, MAD. And this is very destabilizing in the world. Larry, I think you're absolutely right. The global center of gravity has moved east, and it's somewhere near China now. And the only quibble I would have, Larry, with your statement is I don't like the term multipolar, because a pole is a two-dimensional thing with two ends. And I think we're talking about multinodal world. A node is a connecting point for multiple lines of communication and trade, and it's also three-dimensional. It can rotate. It can take thick connections and thin ones, and it can change. I don't think the multipolar image works except in contrast to bipolar, and that's long gone.
No, I agree. I agree. It's a better term would be probably to look at it as a multidimensional world that has different facets of power, cultural, informational, intelligence, military, financial, economic, and so forth. But the indisputable fact, and I think this is why we're doing what we're doing, I don't know if Biden was aware of this. I do know that George W. Bush was aware of it in a very almost animal-like way, inchoate way, but he was aware of it, that the power is bleeding eastward. And therefore, we got the 2002 National Security Strategy, which said essentially, we're going to stop that. We're going to stop it. It is not going to go that way. We're going to stop it. And we're going to use military power and sanctions primarily to stop it.
King Canute again.
Yep.
You know, I mean, at the Munich Security Conference, the representatives of our new administration were very clear. We're leaving you people on the other side of the Atlantic to your own devices and focusing on the Pacific. So we have finally resolved a longstanding conflict in our focus, most evident in World War II, but always there between transatlantic and transpacific focuses. And we're now clearly focused on the Pacific. And in my view, we're very fecklessly focused on the Pacific. We are not getting our own act together in a way to accomplish the competition we posit we are in.
And there's no, Nima, there's no greater indication of that than what we're doing in a sort of infinitesimal way, if you will, but nonetheless indicative, to revitalize the chain of island bases that we had in World War II. I was looking at pictures of Tinian, for example, the other day, where we have bulldozers and guardsmen and active duty all beavering away to build 10,000, 12,000 foot airstrips and so forth, as if China doesn't know why we're doing that.
One reason we're doing it is because closer into China is probably a place where you can't survive for very long.
Yes. Which they know.
If we assume that the power is changing from the West to the East, what would be the main, what would be the crucial sort of attitude on the part of the United States to make some sort of change in what's going on? Here is Donald Trump talking about putting an end to the conflict in Ukraine. We know that Russia has a crucial and substantial and important role in what's going on right now between the East and the West. Is that Russia important in making some sort of balance between East and the West?
Well, I think the Trump administration clearly believes that it is. We have Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, on record with Breitbart, a right-wing news outfit, saying that the whole purpose of the effort to do a sort of reverse Nixon with Russia is to be able to focus on China. And as we recruited China to help in the containment of the Soviet Union, we hope to recruit Russia to contain China. I think this is absolute fiction, fantasy foreign policy, but that appears to be a large part of the motive, at least on the part of Mr. Trump's subordinates. What he thinks, he's not a geopolitical thinker by any means. I suspect he's more interested in Russian natural resources and a good relationship with a strongman in Moscow than he is in the geopolitical dimensions of the rapprochement. But as Larry said, from minute to minute, you can't tell what he's focused on.
And Nima, I think what he said, I think it was 13 February, in addition to wanting to stop the Ukraine war, as being a favorable statement. Maybe he's not going to do it the way it should be done, but he said that he and Putin had talked about a 50% reduction in nuclear weapons. Well, let's get right on that. Let's get right on that. And let's invite Xi Jinping. Maybe even let's invite him to be a person who would add to the pie, as it were, that he would stop his program to build out. If we would stop our programs and cut our stockpiles by 50%. And people say, well, that's preposterous. Nima, in 1991, 92, and 93, with good, wise leadership from Jim Baker and H.W. Bush and Colin Powell and Helmut Kohl and Francois Mitterrand and Edward Shevardnadze and a host of others who participated, we destroyed 50,000 nuclear warheads. It can be done. And we were fought tooth and nail. We were fought by the niche nuclear weapons complex in America, to a certain extent in Russia. Unfortunately, some of the Russians went to Korea and gave them a new addition to their expertise at making nuclear weapons. But we really did some work and got rid of some of the most dangerous, if not the most dangerous, weapons on the face of the earth. We can do that again.
I agree with Larry about that. I think, however, the more likely outcome is that the Chinese, once they will not agree to that until they have built up to a position where they can feel somewhat equal, that we'll have to build down. We could do that. We could do that. We should do that. What is the point of having the world, the ability to destroy the world 40 times over?
Yeah. And Do you see the role of Europe and European countries as positive in what's going on? Or because here is what the Polish Prime Minister Tusk said, that Europe must enter into an arms race with Russia and win. How is that possible, this sort of concept, with while we are having European countries thinking this way?
It's very wrong-headed to think there's a military solution to issues of balance of power and security in Europe. I think the proper model is the Congress of Vienna, the Concert of Europe, an inclusive structure of some sort. I think that's what the Russians are demanding. That is to say, in a political framework in which Ukraine is guaranteed neutrality, maybe along the lines of the Austrian State Treaty of 1955, and in which Russia is reassured that it is not going to be attacked from the West, and the West is assured that it is not going to be attacked from Russia. I don't think that's impossible. We've seen that sort of thing before, but it's an incredibly complicated process to get there. And I'm not sure this goes to whether Mr. Trump's, I think, very sound instincts trying to end the war in Ukraine are going to be realized in fact. I think this requires a level of diplomatic sophistication that isn't much in evidence in this administration so far, anyway.
I couldn't agree more. John Quincy Adams, as a 14-year-old, was at Catherine's court, which spoke only French. And he gave better reports and more fulsome reports, if you will, on Russia than probably any diplomat from any country. And then later he went back as an adult, one of our best ambassadors, and was at Alexander the First's court, the ruler after Catherine, and gave such good reports that it was said we knew more about Napoleon's movement than European leaders. Russia has, from that time forward, at least in my reading of their history, wanted to be a member of Europe. And they've been rebuffed just about every time they have put feelers out or tried to do it. The latest rebuff was probably, again in my memory, historical anyway, the very worst, because we started the process. Russia was going to be an observer status member of the political and the military organization in NATO with expectation that they would be a full member later on if the vote could be cast. And it all went to hell with Bill Clinton, and it went to hell because Bill Clinton wanted to expand NATO in order to get money into the defense contractors so they could contribute to the Democratic Party and the Congress in his own campaign, and because he was scared to death of Colin Powell being his opponent in 1994, 95, and he needed to build up his bona fides in the national security arena so he ran around becoming a war president and becoming a man who presided over the industrial complex. He even invited a committee of contractors in to recommend whether or not they should expand NATO. Well, guess what they recommended? I want to sell F-16s to Poland. Hell yes, I want to sell them. We just screwed the pooch, but we need to come back to the idea that Russia is a part of Europe. And we need to come back to the idea that the European security architecture, once we get past this mess in Ukraine, needs to include Russia. And if we have to do that over the heads of Europe, so be it. And if they go for the way that was just demonstrated by those words that were spoken about going to military instruments and so forth, goodbye social programs, goodbye everything that Denmark becomes the number one country in the world for happy citizens for, goodbye everything that Europe has done in the way of healthcare, education, and so forth, because they'll be spending it like we do on armaments. I was at GW 2 days ago giving a lecture to a bunch of mid-level bureaucrats from all over the federal government. And the philosopher that was with me there, we were a tag team, the philosopher was talking about how to these guys out there, these guys and gals who were in the military or in the CIA, were, do you realize that you're sacrificing the American people's health care? Do you realize you're sacrificing their happiness? You realize you're sacrificing much of what this country could be because of what you're doing? And he's right. $1 trillion now is the NDAA. Interest payments on the debt are $1 trillion. In 10 years, there'll be $2 trillion, and we'll have a $50 trillion aggregate debt. A lot of this has nothing to do with Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. Sure, that's part of it, and they need to be reformed. But a huge component of it is $1 trillion we're spending on defense.
It's not a sustainable path.
No.
I think, you're absolutely right, though, that the greatest mistake that in European security that was ever made was the decision after World War I to excommunicate both Germany and Russia in the form of the Soviet Union.
Yep.
The only way Europe can enjoy peace and stability is with an inclusive rather than an exclusive order. And we need to find a basis for that. However, the sad thing is that I think you're right. For 300 years from the time of Peter the Great in Russia, the Russians tried very hard to Europeanize themselves, and they had considerable success. You were, before we came on this, Larry, you were talking about some Russian music, which is impressive and very much part of Western civilization. But the Russians now, like the Turks, have been rebuffed. And the Russians have turned to China, India, West Asia, Africa, and the Turks have turned to West Asia as a focus, and Central Asia, of course, as focuses. And they both have been alienated by Europe. And I don't think we had too much to do with that in the case of the Turks, but we had a lot to do with it in the case of the Russians. The collapse of the U.S. of the Russia-NATO Council, which was part of the Partnership for Peace architecture, was a tragedy.
Yeah. If we had the Biden administration in Washington, we could understand what would be the behavior of Europeans toward Russia today. But we have Donald Trump, who's totally against this attitude of Europeans. But what is the main concern on the part of them? As we see the way that they're talking about Russia, it seems that Russia is their ultimate enemy and they have to fight Russia. While we know that how Russia is important for a prosperous Europe, for a better future for Europe.
Well, this began, I believe, I may be wrong about this, but I believe it began with the Europeans trying to ingratiate themselves with the United States, which was very bellicose toward Russia. We were in the grip of the neocons. Fortunately, for the moment, we're not. And I think the Europeans started out that way. But they inhaled their own propaganda, and they now are giddy with animosity toward Russia. They actually imagine that somehow Russia, which has made a significant effort to take territory in Ukraine, with rather modest results over 3 years, could somehow, as was the case in the Napoleonic Wars, end up in Paris, conquering everything. And I don't I think that's utterly unrealistic. It is a pure fantasy, but it is what is driving them. And you see divisions in Europe now. Antonio Costa, the president of the European Council, saying very realistically, Europe now has to do a deal with Russia. We've got to come to grips with Russia. You see Friedrich Merz, the chancellor in waiting in Germany, staunch Atlanticist, very pro-American, now saying Europe must become independent and we have to rearm, and people in Germany even talking about nuclear weapons, initially in cooperation with the British and French, but not ruling out their own. This is a very unhealthy and very dangerous course. And one has to hope that they will come to their senses before they go too far down this remilitarization road.
I think we have a lot to do with what the ambassador just described that will be in the history books later. Because we started in the George W. Bush administration a very formidable effort using the CIA's new techniques, amongst other things, those new techniques being using largely NGOs, either wittingly, that is to say, infiltrated by agents, or unwittingly, that is to say, funded and fueled by the agency's plans and by our strategy. And part of that was to get in Europe, elected in as many countries as we possibly could, little Jen Stoltenbergs. And Jen led the way as our man to be Secretary General of NATO. But we caused a lot of countries, and I say a lot because it was a lot, to suddenly have elections that elected people that didn't represent the majority of their people, but represented this angle that we put on them. And prominent in that angle was be a member of NATO. So we persuaded countries that had been independent, had been neutral for so long, suddenly to change their minds, like Finland, and come in. It wasn't Putin's going to attack the entire region. It was the very successful program we ran to get people elected who were the kinds of people we wanted. Call them neoconservative, call them whatever you want, European version. But we did. We put lots of effort and time and money in that. And now we're seeing to a certain extent, or we have seen over the past decade or so, the results of that. I don't think Merz represents Germany. He represents BlackRock, from which he came. He does not represent Germany. And he is going to have a hell of a time ruling. I suspect he's going to fracture. His coalition will fracture very early because there are German people who don't agree with what Merz wants to do. And there are lots of French that don't agree with what Macron wants to do. Colin Georgescu in Romania was a perfect example. And we were in there. We were in there working to try and get him eliminated from the process. We're in Georgia again. We had gotten the party we wanted in Tbilisi. They got out by a legitimate election, barely lost, but they lost. Now we're agitating to get that party out and our old party back in. Why? Because in this case, Biden thought Georgia and Moldova and Romania and others would be better equipped to take on Russia and to support the war in Ukraine. So this is all a conflagration that we created in Europe. We created it by the way we dealt with Europe, starting with the post-9/11 period and my president, George W. Bush. And I'm sad to say, no one deviated in the process since.
There is, we've had a lot of revelations with the implosion of USAID, which was a fine organization devoted to development assistance, but which basically in recent years has been repurposed. And you see and hear so many ironic consequences of the disempowerment of USAID. For example, the press in Ukraine has collapsed. Turns out they're all on our payroll. Yep. I just read today that we're suffering from a lack of knowledge about what's going on in Iran because all the Iranian exile groups we've been funding suddenly are not funded. And, you know, I mean, we built this whole house of cards on basically bribery and corruption, and it's over. And I think we're going to have to reconstitute USAID somehow because that's our soft power. That's how we offset the image we have of warmongering and intervention. By helping, at least pretending that we care about other people. And it's also a first line of defense on things like pandemics and so on. Of course, we're out of the World Health Organization once again. So, and there seem to be quite a number of things brewing. We're really going to regret that. But the revelations of, that count are not things about transgene mice, but about Ukrainian newspapers and broadcasters and Iranian opposition. And as Larry said, opposition in Georgia and the overthrow of electoral results in Romania and so forth. I don't know how we're going to do this if we don't have, this was very clever. The CIA offloaded all this stuff to the National Endowment for Democracy and other organizations. I don't know how we're going to do it if we don't have those institutions. And it would be very good if we didn't do it, in my view.
If we assume that, yeah, go ahead.
I just going to say I don't know that Marco Rubio, and certainly not with the president behind him, backing him, which he would have to do, can do it. But it's like when Jesse Helms took USIA out of the business and forced public diplomacy on the State Department, and it went down to being the cone of no repute. And when we got ACNA disestablished and disarmament and arms control put in the State Department. And then it was so fitting that John Bolton was the first one to be Undersecretary of State for International Security Affairs and Arms Control. And John Bolton told me to my face he despised arms control.
Of course. I actually had two brief tours with USIS in India when I ran. I stood on principle and the ambassador fired me from the State Department, transferred me to the USIS. Best thing that ever happened to me. Got a great management experience, had a lot of fun. And again, in Washington for a short time. And we made a huge mistake because we imagined that, the line was, we don't need to do this anymore because, hey, the Cold War is over. We don't have any interest in this ideological struggle that we were in. And second, Fox News can do it for us. And of course, 5 seconds of Fox News will turn almost any foreigner into an anti-American. So this wasn't too smart.
If we assume that the main goal would be a better relationship with Russia in a long run, how can the U.S. achieve that? Is that possible? Is this new attitude of Donald Trump of having a new deal, mineral deal and rare earth deal, I don't know, whatever it is, an economic tie or economic ties between the United States and Russia, which would benefit the both parties, which would bring them together to understand each other. Is that the future for the relationship between the East and between Russia and the West?
Seems to be the aspiration. In Riyadh, in addition to talking about Ukraine, which frankly, we've never really cared much about Ukraine except as an instrument to go after Russia. And Ukrainians have paid dearly for their cooperation in that effort. The main talk seems to have been, well, there were several agreements. One, the foreign ministers will stay in touch. Two, will appoint, and we have appointed negotiating teams to meet in Istanbul to continue to explore a rapprochement and a peace in Ukraine. Then there was talk about a broad cooperation, both geopolitical and economic. I think the geopolitical cooperation, as I said earlier, that they had in mind was enlisting Russia against China, which I think is not going to happen, but you can dream, I guess. The economic cooperation is lusting after Russia's enormous treasure house of natural resources, perhaps cooperation in the Arctic, cooperation on oil, maybe outflanking OPEC, things like this, and of course, rare earths. I mean, the irony is that the rare earths in Ukraine, which are not terribly abundant to begin with, about 5% of the global resources in rare earths are there. Mr. Trump for a while was talking about raw earths. I noticed in his speech in the Congress, he was very careful to say rare earths. But the irony is that almost all of them are under Russian control in the four oblasts and the Crimea that they have taken most of. And so Mr. Putin very cleverly said, of course, we'd be very happy to have American companies come and exploit our rare earths. You all come. And I think probably there are many companies that would love to go there. And Mr. Trump does seem to think more like a businessman or maybe a real estate developer. Mm-hmm. He's basically foreclosing on Ukraine. They didn't pay their mortgage. Actually, they didn't have one because we, contrary to what he says, we gave gifts rather than, and grants rather than loans. And so did the Europeans. But the fact is they didn't pay their mortgage and therefore we're going to take their assets put them through bankruptcy procedure. And same thing in Gaza. Another foreclosure, like his dad used to do in New York, call the police, evict the tenants, pull the building down and put something new in its place for rich people. This is what is happening. And I don't think it has a lot to do with geopolitics, frankly. although the effects are enormous at the geopolitical level.
Yeah, I have to say, Nima, my concerns are growing hourly with regard to the conflagration in the Levant rather than Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine's still serious, of course, and I agree with the ambassador that it's going to take a lot and a long time probably to settle it all. But the fracas in Gaza and on the West Bank, East Jerusalem, now in Syria, deep into Syria, is really concerning. Concerning from a point of view that I think Israel is stretched right now, if that's not too light a term, militarily speaking. The new commander there has just let it be known through private channels that the reservists that are going to have to be called up for this new assault on Gaza going to be trouble. There's already trouble with people not showing up or people saying they're not going to report for duty and such. So the IDF has never been through anything like this before in its short history. It's never been through it. And I would say right now with the orders to go back in, which these are the orders right now, as I understand it, and resume the offensive in the north and then move south again and do what they did before several times again and again until they defeat Hamas. And they're not going to do that. They're not going to defeat Hamas. He's going to be taking Israel to a point where it is so weak and so obviously weak that we might get something that we wouldn't expect to happen from Arab armies. And we might even get others jumping in. Right now, we have Damascus issuing directions to its forces, such as they are, to move up and to begin to confront the Israelis on the ground, because they're taking water. They're taking whole rivers and dams, and they're taking settlements that are very prolific, thank you very much, or would be if they were back farming again. And it's not it's just not something that the Syrians expected after all this. And you've got a lot coming back. I was told the other day about 1.5 million or so have come back, and they've come back to find our sanctions still in place and a miserable situation. And now we're looking at video of people moving back out of the north, Jews moving back out of the north, like next to Lebanon, where they had come back in for a brief time because they thought they were assured they'd be secure. Well, they're leaving again. So this situation is getting fragile. And the only thing that's going to save it, if it goes militarily fragile against Israel, that is to say they get an existential situation, is us. And we're going to put troops on the ground? We're going to put troops on the ground in Israel? And I haven't even mentioned Iran. I've just talked about the Arab armies and the Ottoman army, if you will. I don't think Erdogan's going to march into Ukraine and help Ukraine, but I do think that they might do something in Syria should they keep going the way they're doing right now, which is apparently they're going to take about a half of Syria before this is over with, at least from the air. They're going to make sure that nothing can move in that half of Syria because of the Israeli Air Force. And Iran is watching all this, and Russia's watching all this, and ultimately China's watching all this. And we're watching all this with a man who doesn't know what he's doing, frankly. He doesn't know what he's doing. I agree with the ambassador that it's a real estate deal. And in this case, it's kicking somebody out and getting a new tenant, one who's a lot richer and can, you know, make a lot more money for you. That's not what this is. This is a deadly serious conflict. And oh, by the way, the Israelis have nuclear weapons. Don't anybody forget that. They have nuclear weapons. And they have something called the Samson option. And Golda Meir in 1972, when asked by the BBC if she would use that option, she said without blinking an eye, of course I would.
I think you're right. I think the Schwerpunkt, the focus of all this may be the Philadelphia corridor. Yep. Because that's a violation of the Camp David Accords, and it's intolerable to Egypt. And the Egyptians, they're very accommodating, nice people, great sense of humor, and all that. But everybody's got a breaking point in terms of the level of humiliation they will accept. So we have the Israelis now illegally occupying 5 bases in southern Lebanon, which they have declared they won't leave. They've built at least 7 such bases in Syria. They are acquiring territory, which is a gross violation of international law. And yet we excuse them, and we don't just excuse them, we aid and abet and help them do it when we take the opposite position in Ukraine. That makes no sense at all. It's a world of that is completely lawless. And I think, you know, the mobilization of 400,000 reservists is going to be, as you said, Larry, will be very difficult because we've had, you know, Israel's had something over 600,000 people emigrate during this period. They've had something like 80,000 small business bankruptcies caused by the war and the strain on their society. Their bond rating has gone down. They are divided not only over the extent to which the judiciary should be independent in Israel, but also in the treatment of the ultra-Orthodox and in Netanyahu's disdain for the families of the hostages. And in the background, the Zionist vision has always been the same. It's consistent. They want to depopulate Palestine. They want to depopulate Gaza. I really find a lot of the news reporting in our society very difficult to listen to because it just ignores the obvious reality that Zionism is all about evicting the Palestinians. And if you can't evict them, kill them. And they've done a pretty good job of that in killing a much larger number than the oft-cited Hamas-controlled health ministry in Gaza figures of 48,000 or so, probably more like 300,000 or 400,000 dead, but I don't know. We won't know until this is all over, but the level of death and destruction is really almost indescribable and certainly nauseating to observe, and yet we do nothing.
And Nima, I'll just add to that, that I've just come back from my old campus, College of Women Mary, where I never thought I would see their student newspaper, the Flathat, which has always been a vehicle for student expression, if you will, sometimes very strident student expression. On the front page, bottom of that page, is an article about the suppression of people's rights on the campus of William & Mary. And that suppression has to do with Palestinian protests or protests of the situation in Gaza. I never thought I would see that. And then I pick up a paper this morning and Trump has withdrawn $400 million from Columbia University. This is sickening. The last bastion of excellence in the American empire is our university system, and we are destroying it.
I agree.
And we're destroying the Constitution too.
I agree. The Constitution, the rule of law, due process are all memories. I hope they can be revived, but I'm not confident.
Larry, in your opinion, to what extent Donald Trump would risk a wider and bigger conflict in the Middle East if we assume that as Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, all of these people are talking about attacking Gaza again. Is Donald Trump prepared to help them militarily?
Mm-hmm. Yes. When I was down at William & Mary giving a talk to the League of Women Voters in the library there, my 14th year to do it, I asked, anybody here? The first time I came, and about 12 hands went up. Average age of the audience is 80. one of the gentlemen there, I knew him. So we went to lunch afterwards, and it turns out he's Lieutenant General Paul Van Ripper, Riper. We called him the Ripper. But he was my boss when I first took over the Marine Corps War College. So he also did a war game. He did a very good war game where we went to war with Iran and we lost. They were so angry with him for doing that. He was head of the Marine Corps Development and Education Command. we did all the simulating and war gaming. They were so angry with him for that verdict, they asked him to do it again, and he did, and we lost again. The Pentagon knows in its bowels that were the United States to go to war with Iran and ultimately have to put troops on the ground, because you are not going to get rid of their nuclear complex or even the software in their heads unless you go afoot and you destroy everything and you occupy. That's disaster. You think Iraq was a disaster? Iran would be a complete 10 times as bad disaster. Trillions of dollars, lots of casualties, and a permanent occupation. 90 million people instead of 26 million, a huge terrain difference. I had to study Iran when we were thinking that the Soviets would come out of Afghanistan and go to the Persian Gulf for a warm water port. And I had to do some war planning for fighting in Iran. And I said, we do not want to fight here. We do not. And that's the Pentagon's view for so long. That's what they're going to give Hegseth as advice. And Hegseth, I don't know what he'll tell the president, but we do not need to get into a war with Iran.
I think military exercises are often wonderful. I remember participating in an Air Force exercise dealing with an insurgency in Qatar and the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. And of course, the Air Force is totally irrelevant to that.
Yes.
But of course, they were very upset when they lost.
Ambassador, well,
the Houthis are sort of proving that right now.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
I would wonder how the Middle East, the situation in the Middle East fits in the bigger picture in the mind of the strategists, those people, decision makers, I don't know whoever they are in the United States. How do they see the Middle East, the case, the situation in the Middle East for the bigger picture, for a broader picture of the conflict between the East and the West? Is that important for them, or they're going to have a much higher chaos in that region, which would not benefit the United States, in my opinion?
Well, I'd question your assumption that there are strategists thinking about this. I think we have a bigger strategy deficit than we do a balance of payments and balance of trade deficit. We're just not thinking that way. I suspect that is a lingering effect of the Cold War, where we had a grand strategy called containment that was provided to us 1947 or so. And it was a very good strategy, and it eventually succeeded. The Soviet Union defaulted in its contest for global supremacy with us, and we were left standing while it collapsed. But it was such a good grand strategy that we lost the capacity to think strategically, in my view. So I don't know. I think when you look at what's happening in West Asia, it's a product of various domestic political attitudes, the Israel lobby, primarily, evangelical Christian support for Zionism, lack of understanding of Arabs and Islam, I don't think it's a strategic thing. I think it's more nostalgic than strategic. Larry, do you disagree with that?
No, I do not. I think we've had a grand strategic and even a strategic, as we'd say in the military, the level right below that deficit, clearly since H.W. Bush left the White House.
Right. Right. I mean, a strategy is a plan with objectives, resources devoted to them, adequate to achieve the objectives, economic use of those resources, and a termination strategy. When you get to the objectives, you regroup. We don't even set termination strategies. That's why we have forever wars.
I once told Colin Powell that I thought the reason we had such a strategic deficit was because we knew we didn't have the means, so we just did anything.
Could be. I mean, it's absolutely crucial that you fit the resources to the objectives, and you don't have objectives that exceed your grasp.
Yeah,
we routinely do. And in fact, I've often thought, you know, I was appointed to be the head of the National Intelligence Council, and was for a minute or two. I thought I was really lucky I wasn't in the initial meeting in the Obama administration about Afghanistan, because he, in the sit room, the situation room, he asked whether there was anybody present who thought we should leave Afghanistan. And I would have raised my hand and said, I think we should leave when we achieve our objectives. And by the way, what are those objectives? And I don't think anybody could have answered.
I don't either.
Anyway,
yeah.
Thank you, Nima, for bringing Larry in. He's a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. Just before wrapping up this session, Ambassador, here is what Fox News reported.
Look at my head, though. I've got no computer.
Yeah. Here is what Fox News reported, that Trump wrote a letter to Iran saying he would rather make a deal than use weapons. And the foreign minister of Iran responded that Iran will not negotiate with the United States while under pressure. And it seems that Donald Trump is putting a lot of pressure on Iran right now, and new sanctions are going to Iran, and while he tries to negotiate with Iran. What is your understanding of what's going on in the mind of the Trump administration?
Well, the characteristic approach to negotiations of the Trump administration is to open with threats, bluster, and sanctions, pressure. Maximum pressure can have an effect. The application of that to North Korea produced a nuclear threat to the United States that wouldn't have otherwise eventuated, in my view. But the problem is that Iran is a very proud country. It will not easily negotiate under threat. But there's another problem, and that is Mr. Trump is the very person who invalidated the previous negotiation. And he has a record, after the Canadians and Mexicans, of repudiating any previous agreements done, even by himself, not just other presidents. If I were to guess, I would say that it's very hard for the Iranians, much as they want a deal, because clearly they do. It's very hard for them to agree to a negotiation with Donald Trump. And because will he keep his agreement if he makes it? Will he try to humiliate Iran, or will he do what you have to do to produce a lasting result, namely respect the views of the other side and give them some dignity? I don't know.
Nima, after listening to Javad Zarif, the vice president in Davos a few weeks ago, and trying to kind of read between the lines, I think if Donald Trump really does possess the Congress, the Iranians would insist on a treaty and a two-thirds majority in the Senate ratifying that treaty. And he might be able to achieve it.
He could, possibly. But the question then would be, would he keep even that?
Yeah. And I find it hard after, I didn't watch it, but I read about it and I listened to some of the excerpts on YouTube. The Democrats, just to spite him, might not go along with it.
Well, there's also the Israel lobby to be considered.
Yes.
Not easy.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ambassador Chas Freeman and Colonel Wilkerson.
Did you read up on the Serrato?
What?
Did you read up on the Serrato?
No.
That's a very disquieting article in National Geographic. Apparently, the land's going at, I forget the figure, but it's 4,000 square miles a month or something like that. It's huge, of course, but that's a pretty rapid rate of land destruction.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Nima, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Great pleasure, as always.
And thank you, Larry.
See you. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ambassador. Good to see you looking good. Looking good.
Well, it's deceptive, but anyway.
Since I passed 80, it's deceptive here, too.
Yeah, I'm well over that age.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.